This is Dig Deep. That's Aaron Brown along with Chuck Marone. We're discussing Chuck's new book that is out. It's called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. It'd be great if we could get some city leaders from various cities in KEXE, KBXE's listening area to the event in December. What an interesting conversation we would have there. But let's talk about some of this. You touched on this, some of this history and what we once thought was progress and where we're at now. You use this phrase in your title, to rebuild American prosperity. What did it look like? What do we think it looks like? What should it look like?
Right. I hope this comes through. The lengths that I go to say that I'm not looking back at the past with nostalgia, thinking this was perfect. There's good reasons why after World War II, when given the opportunity, people abandoned cities and developed this different building pattern. I mean, cities have long been places of great difficulty. And, you know, the problems that we worked out in cities, the problems that we faced were numerous and many. And it's kind of hard to, I think one of the hardest things about making the case that I'm making that these traditional cities had a lot of spooky wisdom. They had worked out a lot of competing things and they had harmonized a lot. I call it many times human habitat, this habitat that co-evolved with us to meet our needs. It's hard to balance that insight with the fact that these weren't always great places. You had congested living, you had bad air, you had poor sewage and water treatment, and you had a lot of reasons why people, when they were given the opportunity, said, I would rather have a half acre lot on the edge of town than be stuck here in this neighborhood any longer. To take that insight and kind of build on it, I think that there's two different paths we could have gone down. And this is where I hope we ultimately get to, Aaron, at the towards the end of this conversation. It's the progressive nature of this shift. If you go back to the 1920s, there were kind of two brands of progressives when it came to cities. One you can think of as the City Beautiful movement. And the City Beautiful movement was, let's take cities as they are today and let's tweak them. We know that having green space and parks makes cities nicer. So let's put some green space and parks in. We know that having better air circulation and more light does that. So let's, you know, if you go to New York today and you see in New York City, the older skyscrapers where they kind of step back, they have this weird step back. That's so that more light can get in and shine in on the buildings. Because if you put up a very tall, straight building, it will block the light from the next building. If you slope it back a little bit, the light will get in. That was a progressive era reform in the 19-teens, 1920s. There was a movement to basically tweak the city and make it more livable, better. We'll put in sewer systems, we'll put in water systems, we'll get the horse manure out of the streets, and we'll bring in this new invention, the streetcar or the automobile ultimately, and we'll fix these problems. There was another progressive vision, and this was really, I think, a minor vision that grew during the Depression and World War II, and really the centralization of the economy, the fact that we had these urgent problems that now we're going to have a council of economic advisors and we're going to try to, you know, boost the economy and get things revved up. And we vested a lot of power and centralized authority in making growth happen. Out of that camp came this idea that the way we fix the city is we denude it. We spread it out across the landscape. We take this new innovation called the automobile, we deploy it across the landscape in this very kind of new, never been done way before. We basically take the idea of the English gentry living in their manor and the English countryside, you know, to escape the city, the queen leaves Buckingham Palace every year and goes out to the countryside, and we'll let everybody live that way all the time. So why can't we? We just won the war. We've got all the gold. We've got all the oil. We've got the world's reserve currency. We have all this economic might. Why wouldn't we put that towards rebuilding this better version of America? It's interesting because if you go over to Europe, where their cities were destroyed after World War II, they started to build in this pattern. A lot of these ideas actually came from them. It came from European intellectuals, their think tanks, their universities came up with what is our suburban development pattern. they started to build it, and they're like, this is not how you build cities. Their culture of cities were so deep that even when they were destroyed and had the opportunity to rebuild them, they went back and built what they had. They basically replaced what they had. They didn't build it in this new model. We, on the other hand, tore down our cities. They weren't decimated by war. We voluntarily tore them down, and we built this brand new idea. This is where I feel like I slide into my confirmation bias, my conservative confirmation bias. When I look back at this and see the, while today this pattern has grown to be very important to conservatives, and conservatives look at the freedom of the automobile and the individual liberty to live where you want, and the idea of having your own home as your own castle and not living in a community where you would kind of have these neighborhood bonds that would have to develop because of how you live. That's become dear to conservatives. The kind of pernicious part of it is that it all began as a big progressive experiment. Here's how we reshape America along a new vision and new ways of doing things. It's the confluence of the fact that now our reach actually matched our vision, that we were able to transform an entire continent within a generation in a way that no humans in all of history ever had even the capacity to do, let alone have that vision become reality.
So if you'll indulge a little bit of history and discussion about the project I'm working on, because after reading, I read the book while working on my book, and of course that means that somewhere in the mass of my brain, Chuck influenced me somehow in some perhaps unknown way. But he did awaken a realization of sorts of a good example that I think he'll dig. But I wanted to just point out, I'm writing about a town, Hibbing, founded in 1893, tenfold increased in population by 1913. Okay, so it's 20 years and it's 10 times as big as it was. And this is true of a lot of Iron Range towns. As more miners came from all over the place to work these rapidly expanding mining interests, these towns exploded in population. They became boom towns. What made Hibbing different than a lot of other range towns was that by happenstance of land ownership, geography, and the location of the iron ore, Hibbing, Minnesota was trapped in a smaller footprint than the other range towns. More so than the other towns, developers, business people had to build up rather than out when they built the original town site. You can read it in the newspapers. I don't know if you can quantify it exactly, but the most stark thing about comparing the tone of people's comments in the old newspapers versus when the town moved to the south, I'll talk about that, and it was a bigger footprint, was the sense of community that was clearly evident. And there's a show, and maybe this is way too obscure, but like there's a show, Deadwood, that was on HBO about...
I watched it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's a Wild West town. One of the things about, if you feel like watching a show that has a little bit of swearing in it, you could check that out. But one of the things that struck me about what that show depicted, fictionally, semi-fictionally, was... This notion of there's all of these strivers, rivals, opponents, frenemies, allies at sometimes, enemies at others, and they all have to live right on top of each other. They walk down the street, and they may want to kill that person, but they can't quite kill them today because it's not convenient. It doesn't work out that way. But and you got to walk down the same sidewalk.
Well, and the social pressure. You might want to kill him, but the social pressure from the third guy who you do need to work with would keep you from doing
that.
Right.
And this is how Hibbing was. I mean, I'm not saying that they all walk around with six shooters on their hips or anything, though there was some of that. It was after the Wild West period. But it was like this in that two people who might be great rivals in city politics or Democrat and Republican or whatever would have to then know each other and work with each other in so many other ways. And it really kind of reminded me in a way of almost this ideal community that Chuck was describing in the development of communities. You know, they started as shacks and then they tore down the shack and they built a square boxy building. And then that building was too small and they built a three-story wooden office building. And you could just see how this was going to develop and develop. And unlike a lot of range towns that grew out as people snatched up real estate, these business people were very successful staying right where they were. And they didn't necessarily want that. And you could see how, had they not discovered iron ore beneath that town, it might have been a very different place today, because the next phase was going to be brick buildings. And I could imagine, in fact, the people I'm researching, the Powers, Victor and his brother Walter, were from Calumet, Michigan. And I actually think Calumet was where they were headed. They were going to build up in these beautiful brick businesses and office buildings, and it was going to be something really special. They discovered ore, they had to move the town to the south. But before that, when it was merely a suspicion that they would have to move, the guy I'm researching, Victor Power, makes a decision in 1913 when he's elected mayor, 6 years before most of the moving took place. He decides that it would be make good sense for the town to annex the village of Alice, which is another 40-acre slot south of the town site. It's just a little location village.
It's probably a couple shacks.
Yeah, right. There's a little more than that, but it's just not a city yet. You know, it's not like Hibbing. It doesn't have five theaters. It doesn't have 70 bars like Hibbing does. It's not there yet. And so he annexes, he and his allies in government, the progressives, and they are literally progressives. It's right after Teddy Roosevelt. Right. These guys run on the Progressive Party ticket for Hibbing. They beat a stodgy old conservative ticket. They're Republicans in politics, but they're progressive Republicans. And so they sweep in and they annex Alice. They even talk about annexing the township and going all the way up to Sturgeon Lake. Now, if you know the geography of Side Lake and McCarthy Beach State Park today, what is now McCarthy Beach State Park, they thought would make a really nice retreat park for all the citizens of Hibbing. It's 15 miles away. They wanted to annex it and operate it as a municipal park. So they were annexing property. And in the midst of all this, a woman that I'm including in my narrative, Walter's the older brother. He was a mayor. Victor was the younger brother. He served longer and with perhaps more fanfare. Dottie Power is Walter's wife. And she's a remarkable woman because she's probably the most successful business person in the city of Hibbing, and is enough so that nobody even tries to say, oh yeah, her husband did that for her. It's very clear in how they talk about her that she is the businesswoman. And she's the only married woman in 20 years to be referred to by her real name in the newspaper, not her husband's name. So Dottie Power, she's in the paper all the time, but only talking about business, the new fashions available. She runs a dry goods and clothing store. New fashions that she came out to New York and got and brought back. And so she talks about all that. But there's one letter to the editor that she writes. It's one paragraph long. And she writes it when Hibbing's about to annex Alice Township. And she writes, her only political opinion that I've found yet in the paper, other than her related to her business, that if Hibbing annexes Alice, our property values in Hibbing are going to go down, and that it may lead to consequences that we don't want.
She's very astute.
Very astute.
Yeah.
And I knew that I read that, and then I read your book. I'm like, Chuck would want to talk to Dottie.
I absolutely would.
Because, and she's right. What she said was exactly right. Not only did it depress the value of the businesses in Old Hibbing, but that may have even been by design. When you think about what happened and the fact that they all suspected there was ore under the old town site, it became a great convenience to depress those values of property and encourage people to move south. And what was Alice is now Hibbing. That's the site of modern-day Hibbing, is the village of Alice. Now, you might say, like, oh, progress, you couldn't stop it. They were powerless, no pun intended, to stop this move and this development pattern. But it makes you think for a second about what they had stumbled on by accident in North Hibbing before World War II, before the development patterns that we're talking about, and how they were dealing with the same primordial pressures. So I just wanted to share that with you, Chuck.
I describe it as if you look at like a petri dish and you're growing a culture in a petri dish, it will grow outwards, it will grow upwards. But in Hibbing, you hit the edge.
Yeah.
And then what you have is that it just starts to layer on top of each other. It just grows up. And what you're seeing there is the wealth of the place. Because, you know, all of a sudden, you've got a three-story structure there. It has way more wealth than Alice, where you've got these little one-story pop-up shacks out on the edge. You have tremendous wealth, and it becomes, and I think this is the part where the progressives started to, I think, rightly point out, like, cities become overly hierarchical and overly kind of constraining on economic mobility. Because if you own the land in Hibbing now, mm-hmm. there's no more. Like God is not making more Hibbing because you had these constraints.
And you were seeing that because the original business people who had the foresight to show up and buy the land cheap were now the power brokers.
They were doing great.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and nobody else was going to share in that, really, mm-hmm. until you spilled the banks of those constraints. If you go to a city like Brainerd or even Grand Rapids here, what you see is that the core of the city would have had immense value. That's why we were building in Brainerd. We were 20 years ahead. It was 1870s when Brainerd formed. It was basically a generation ahead. And so we weren't stuck at the wood three-story office buildings. You had brick and concrete and granite buildings, and you had these like gorgeous structures that were starting to be erected. If you go further east in this country, you know, go to Chicago, go to Indianapolis, what have you, you've got even more mature buildings because they were a generation, two, three ahead of us. What you see is that these buildings were only built that grandiose because the land underneath them was really valuable. And the land underneath them was valuable because it was centrally located and everybody walked and you got around in a much different way that made that property really incredibly valuable. It almost became stifling because a new person could get a start out on the edge, but until the edge kind of grew up and created its own center, that edge was going to stay marginal. And even when it did grow up, it was going to make the center even wealthier, like exponentially wealthier. The automobile changed all that, like overnight. And you can just look at it from a simple supply-demand standpoint. If you run a highway through the middle of a city, and now you say the land 3 miles out of town is equally as accessible as the land in the middle of town. In fact, by automobile, it's almost more because you can have a bigger parking lot. And in town, you're going to have to fight with people over parking. All of a sudden, the land out on the edge has way more value than it had before it was accessible. So that land is now worth a lot more. And we see this as a course of business today that, you know, the person out on the edge turns their $1,000 lot into a $40,000 lot overnight. It's like, wow, that's incredible. But we don't have to look at the reciprocal because when you increase the supply of land exponentially, I mean, by 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times, but you don't increase the demand by that much, you just destroy the land values in the center of the town. You absolutely decimate them. And so in a place like Brainerd, we actually found it at one point more valuable to tear down our railroad building and make it a parking lot. We tore down our granite bank and made that into a parking lot. We tore down all these just monumental historic structures and made them parking lots because the land, they literally had more value in that system now as parking than they did as like the structure they were, because the automobile and the investments that we made decimated the land values of cities. It basically destroyed generations of wealth, and with that, generations of stability.
You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE KBXE, our podcast as well.